So get someone in the company to talk to you about it.
Or there
through
might
a joint venture, perhaps, even.
Yeah, or find somebody who may be a little more of a maverick that does something
who's
has access to them, who can introduce you on that level.
Who's selling something to them already that already has their relationship?
On the other hand, I would ask you two other questions, one of which is, why do you want to sell to them? And you can't answer that for yourself. And do you really need to sell to them? And if you do want to sell to them, you better address their needs.
You've got to go next. You've got to go next. We're going to run out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Long, Bay Area, Northern California. I want to start a business in putting together joint ventures. And I want to get some idea how to structure one. And I have a specific interest in, say, host-parasite relationship between two companies.
So what's the question, Margaret?
Well, I just want to have some idea of how to structure one where the middleman doesn't get cut out, for example, and also.
But you got to help. You got to be real specific. Give me a specific question. So
example, say you're a middleman and you want to put together a host-parasite kind of relationship between two businesses, and one business, its products could lend itself to be exported overseas, say to the Pacific Rim, and it has no experience overseas yet. And the other company has an established customer base and network overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And they have related products that could be easily sold to the other customer base.
Okay.
Could you give me an idea how I could go about structuring it and then not to be cut off as the middle person once I get it?
You have a product. What is the you in the deal? Are you basically...
The middle
are you
person.
Organizing or are you one of the company?
Are you a middle person or just...
Yeah, we don't know what
the middle person.
Okay, so you're basically, you're bringing it together.
You're bringing it together, yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess the first thing you'd have is certain kinds of documentation. Number two, you could actually buy, I don't know enough about how to use letters of credit, but you could actually buy and sell. You could do flips, couldn't you, Matt?
Well, that might be a little sophisticated for her.
Well, give her a better answer.
You either do what Jay was saying in terms of making sure that all your deals are documented,
mm-hmm.
and everything's in writing and your understanding's good, and you live, breathe, talk, walk every day those deals so they never lose sight of you. You're wired into the deal. You never miss a meeting.
Make them put an office there on their site
for you.
Right.
The other way is to set yourself up as a trading company and you have equal stature with the other partners.
Okay, Rico's got an idea.
I think you need to make sure that you're clear what it is uniquely that you're bringing. If all you're bringing is an introduction, then you'll probably be phased out of the deal as it advances. You need to make sure you're clear that you have more to offer than just that initial connection.
And that you articulate it, too.
Yeah, and you articulate that, and that also you can bring in preconditions to the table that obligate your continued presence, as long as you're bringing value. This is a lot of what's happening in terms of social transformation in business. When we talk about the virtual corporation, you're talking about an increasing, and this also relates to the previous question over here. It relates to how people are doing business also more and more in a way where we don't necessarily have a product, but you're connectors, you're nexoids, you're bringing people together and you're facilitating these connections. So then, therefore, it's that much more essential that the value of that connectivity through you is really, really recognized. Now, if you're not clear about that yourself, you may want to hold back prior to facilitating the introduction. Sometimes we shoot ourselves in the foot because we go too far, too fast. We bring people together, and next thing you know, they're asking themselves, well, why do we need this person? And then you're out of the deal.
Because you didn't revere yourself enough. That's good. Thanks, Margaret.
Let me say, first let me say thank you, I think. I came in thinking I knew little or nothing about marketing, and I'm going home having found out I know little or nothing about customer service, marketing, employee relations, procedures, and now I think I have to rebuild my whole business from the bottom up. And,
well, you're welcome.
It's a lot of work.
Anything else
work
we can do for
me. But essentially our business is a sports center now. It used to be gymnastics, but now it's a lot of sports, and the different aspects of the business have different clientels, like a rock climbing clientele is college kids, teenagers, and adults versus gymnastics, which is preschoolers and elementary children. Is there a way, which I can't see myself, to market our business to all the different clienteles through one marketing plan or strategy, or do we have to conduct several different campaigns for each of the segments?
Yes. The latter.
And having that short answer, a second part would be, do you have a recommended strategy, particular that would be a best strategy to employ in going after that?
Well, what's the that?
Market. Pardon? Which,
if you got all these fragmented markets, there might not be a best strategy. There's going to be optimal strategy. Understand this. If you got seven different markets, you may have to approach each one in a different way or with different composite. If you subscribe to this concept of the Parthenon, you might have to have three or four or five totally different approaches working in Avenue A than you will be using in Avenue C. So there's not an absolute answer. We'd have to sit and do, and I'm trying to be disrespectful, we'd have to do a basic hot seat and figure it all out. What I would suggest for you is to go through all the things we covered, list out which ones have, it's the greatest, I mean, what you're going to do as far as the best strategy, I forgot to give you the finality of the thing, so we better just give you a quick wrap. All you do is you go through all the ideas you've got and you organize them on the basis of which ones are the most highly probable or viable, which ones are the easiest to start, which ones require the least amount of time, effort, or capital, or human capital to get, and those are the ones you do first. And do those across the board, and you'll know if you ask yourself the right, if you ask yourself the right questions, you'll never have a problem. When I say this to you, it's not meant to be patronizing. You know so much more than you'll allow yourself to acknowledge. Mac, you have anything else to offer?
No.
Okay, hope that helps.
Thank you.
Good luck to you.
Louis Fehr Piker, Praxima Corporation, Denver. Thank you again to all of you. It's been a wonderful weekend.
You're welcome.
This is an interesting one. Jay, you do it all the time, which is amazing. Federal Express came into existence. Deepak Chopra's concepts. New ideas come on the line all the time. I'm engaged many times to work with people with new technologies and new concepts that they want to take out and use my ideas as a sounding board or as a distribution method. What is the one thing that, or a main hurdle, first time out of the chutes with a concept that has never even been tried, though you know you've done your research, that there's a need for it, that there's value to it?
What's the question? Is selling it, applying it, using it? What do you want to do with it?
The first thrust out of selling it.
To who? You want to sell it to a third party, or you want to sell it to...
I want to sell it now to the mass market. For example...
Don't sell it to mass market. You go sell it to one person.
Yeah, find out if it's right. Sell it one-on-one.
Sell it to your best and most likely prospect who will talk to you.
Get a copy of the book called My Life in Advertising by Claude Hopkins and read it twice or thrice or 40 times. He was the grandfather of all direct response selling, and he would sell nothing in mass until he could sell it, articulate it, compel people one-on-one. Every time he ever took something, and it's really amazing. If more people did that, they'd be a lot more successful.
Please take the word mass market out of your vocabulary.
You're doing one person at a time, however you look at it. You could run a newspaper ad to a million people, but it's being read by one person at a time.
There are almost no mass markets anymore. You can forget the concept of mass market. It is irrelevant to anything you're doing.
Okay.
You are not Procter & Gamble.
Does that help?
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks.
More people come up. Just sort of go through the rows because I'm going to rush through this.
Okay. I think my question is for the group here.
Okay, great.
What I'd like to do is field test which of three USPs has most resonance in
your
opinion.
Let's figure a vehicle. What's the vehicle of metering you want to use? Claps?
How about hands?
Okay.
And
she's obviously visual.
I'm a management consultant. My name is Lynn Curry Swan. I work in Anchorage, Alaska. And here are the three choices, and then I want to go back and do hands. A is 110% warranty. Why pay for management assistance or training? Pay only for results. B is 110% warranty. You'll get the results you expect, ... and more. C is 110% warranty, : we'll give you the results you want. So here we go.
Wait, put a D there. None of the above.
Oh, no.
Put a D there. None of the
okay,
above.
Okay, D is none of the above.
I'm not suggesting that might be...
that might be the...
I'm just suggesting that would be an interesting option to
well,
add.
Well, if you guys do D, we're going to ask Jay for his answer for me, because this is my second webinar.
Lynn, why don't you put your present company name as D?
Okay. D is the Growth Company, Inc., which is my company name. Here we go. A, 110% warranty, colon. Why pay for management assistance or training, dot, 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 pay only for results? B is, I knew I had to come to this program, this is good feedback. B is 110% warranty, colon. You'll get the results you expect, dot, 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 and more. Interesting, that was my favorite a moment ago. C is 110% warranty. We'll give you the results you want. Wow, what a loser. And D is the growth company, Inc. Funny, too funny. Okay. Jay, would you give me any other USP advice?
Uh-huh. Keep working at it.
Keep working at it. I agree. If I were putting my life on the line, I wouldn't use any of those. If I were putting my fate on the line, I'd try again.
Can I just say one thing? That with the USP, if you focus on what added value do you bring, what is the added value that you bring that your competitors don't? And is it the 100%, 110%? Do they only offer 109%?
But you see, that's right. Because a warranty is not a USP. It's an insurance. Yeah.
If people don't want a warranty, they want a result. They don't want protection of the negative. They want an assurance of the positive, I think, in what you
do. Which is why they like their company name more.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. But that might be part of it. That might be part of it. But you're getting in the right direction. Hello.
Oops, I'll get to you. Hi. Dan Mazzocco, periodontist, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania.
Wait, the empathic periodontist.
I kept Mac up last night. I was the last one to leave. He was very gracious to stay with me, and we wrestled with this problem. And I walked him out of the building almost. And if you could just give me any insight, I'm not sure it's in the form of a question. I guess it is a question, but who is my customer? I'm in a conflict between
your customer
referring doctor.
It's the referring doctor. What did Mac say? That's who it is. It's a referring doctor. That's it. Absolutely. Okay. And you got to look bigger than just. Here you go. You know what I said about looking at, I used an example about the totalistic. Look at them in a more holistic or whole context. Help them with the management of their practice. Help them get themselves more referrals. Help them grow their profits. Help them manage better. Help them motivate. Help them eliminate turnover. Help them get de-stressed. Help them stay healthy. Help them do all kinds of other things, and you'll get more referrals than possible. Send someone to rub their backs. That will work, honest to God, that will work. You're welcome.
American Tactical Systems. Are there any rules you can
give? Are there Teflon-coated bandoleros?
The only thing I have that's Teflon is frying pans.
is that a weapon?
It can be, yes. Anything used to attack another human being becomes an assault weapon.
Can you sell it?
A gun.
Can we get them registered and sell it?
Not okay. For me.
My question. But 357 Magnum frying pans?
The cast iron skillets work best.
What's your question? You're getting us on tangents. You're doing this on purpose. I know.
Where do you use, what role, if any, the videos have, pre-recorded videos, in converting inquiries to sales?
They could have an enormous role. They have been very, very powerful in certain applications. They've been used promiscuously. You'd have to follow a similar contextual guideline to the advertising content. You might want to watch infomercials and see how they are formatted and forensically identify what each segment of them are. My recollection is the average infomercial is about 12-minute
segments
at a time. People got about 12 minutes worth of concentrated viewership. They can be very good if the profit dynamics warrant it, but you got to cost it out because it's not an inexpensive thing. It is, and you can make one yourself for probably a few $1,000s with today's equipment. It may not be the best, but if you start saying we're not trying to be MGM, we're just trying to show the product in action, and we thought that one demonstration visually was much better than just describing it in words, and you disclaimed it and self-effaced a little bit in the beginning, it could be interesting, but only if your average order is going to be large enough to cost justify and only you know it.
Does now, you're talking about sending out a video?
Yes.
Well, you have to make sure that it isn't actually an impediment to sale, because if you create something that somebody has to do before they take action, that can kill your sale. Because if you say you have to listen to this video, and they don't happen to have the VCR handy except for 2 or 3 months.
You might try audio, even though you're showing something and describe it in word pictures. Remember when we did...
The tape?
No, I'm talking about the dolly.
Oh, but when you were, I was thinking about the tape and the packaging.
Oh, yeah, I did tape. We did tapes. We sold... We did audio tapes that we tested, and it increased our yield five times. But a lot of people try audio tapes, and they go downhill with it, and they suppress it.
Because they make it a contingent thing to listen to, not supporting evidence.
Yeah, right. We had a real estate agent who sent out a video, who made an offer in an ad, find out how your children are affected when you have a job transfer. And PBS did the video, and you could buy it from PBS, and they put in an offer for an ad. So I think whenever the video is going to educate people to the next level, so you might use the video to get a different level of a lead.
Point of clarity.
You know.
Killed an insurance officer. Totally killed it.
And what I didn't deal as much in this point of reference is this. I already taught you that you got to test, because every person's application and situation is kaleidoscopically unique. It's as kaleidoscopically unique, it means that certain embodiments that work great for this gentleman may bomb in your application. So you can't just say, well, I got the answer. That's why I didn't want to give you the answer. I want to give you a method of understanding. There are lots of answers. And what works for you may or may not work well or at all for him. So don't presuppose it's singularly the answer to your salvation. Suppose that if you can do it cost effectively, try one ad offering video, one ad or letter offering audio, one ad just offering a letter, because we've had experiences where we've gotten more just painting a mental picture and letting people calculate their own. If I say to men, there is a beautiful, voluptuous woman I want to introduce to you. If I said that to 100 men, there'd be 80 different pictures. Some would see 6-foot-tall, blonde-haired vixens. Some would see 5-foot-2, little pixie-type brunettes. Some would see very farm-looking women. Some would see, you know, real sensuous-looking. If I put a picture of a sensuous-looking woman, that would turn off. Frequently, it wouldn't turn off, but it wouldn't be the vision that you had. Same thing with women. I said a really handsome man. Well, somebody might think mature. Some might think, you know, a guy who's got long hair and open shirt, you know, to the navel. Sometimes you might find that painting descriptive pictures with words and letting the customer come to their own canvas portrait is even better. You got to find out. Anyhow.
Thanks, everyone on the stage and also here for all your input and help. I really appreciate it. What I'm thinking is that I have the same problem as the radiologist. What I'm looking to do is to get a larger share of a diminishing market. Those people with private insurance. I'm involved in capitation. I really don't like it. That's a mindset I know now. But
here's the thing: is you got to say where's the opportunity? Because whether you like it or not, unless you can work, and you could, it's possible to get an elite group of people, the elite group of people with foot problems, to pay you on an elective basis, and that could be something as a sub-strategy.
Like this group here is not going to go into an HMO. You're not going to be in an HMO.
I am not going to be in your HMO. That is correct.
You're not.
No, I'm not. That's true.
But I
may not be.
You would want to be one of my patients if you lived in New Jersey. So what I'm saying is what I want to do is, what I'm looking to do is, Mike probably has a lot of information, all of you probably do.
You got any ideas on that, Mike?
Larger share of a diminishing market. And I don't know if I'm looking to go exclusivity. Do I want to increase marketing? Because I'm big. I'm going to be able to market with all my colleagues.
So what's the question? Give us a very specific question. I'm not trying to be difficult.
What's the best way to go after a larger share of a diminishing market?
Aggressively.
In my situation.
Aggressively.
Aggressively, but with sensitivity, giving them more of what they want or need. And the need means things they've never even realized they could have. And it's abstract because it's almost like what I said to the radiologist.
You must leave no stone unturned. I mean,
right.
You really
that
have
means
to
do it. Find
you told the radiologist to go to make deals with the capitation. My experience, well, also in the state society, is you make a deal with the state, they have 100 doctors behind you ready to take it. Don't take it for 18. He'll take it for 12. He'll take it for 10.
That's not what I said. That is not what I said. What did I say, Matt?
You want me to add more value to the, that capitation agreement, but there's so many...
No, that's not what I said. I said, don't necessarily submit to the fact that you have to abide by, quote, that capitation agreement. Just because they're saying, okay, we're going to send people for this. Maybe you can broaden the scope or change the dynamic so you can have them bid on another basis where you throw something else in that they're going to capitate anyhow, but it's something that you can put in at a different basis and you can absorb through your facility, or you can do a deal with somebody else and combine it and get them to combine two or three elements. So all of a sudden, you're set. Remember that the person said that the request who was it, David? The request you're talking about, the RP? That all of a sudden you create the rules? Well, create the rules. Got a better idea?
And how many people, what kind of practice?
Podiatrists.
Aren't you podiatrist?
How many people do I see?
How many people
are
know
you? What are you?
Employees in your group?
Employees.
So what are you? Are you? Are you chiropractor or podiatrist? What?
Podiatrist.
Yeah, my suggestion is, are you people involved in solving this problem?
Yeah, I mean, I am in every single HMO PPO. I mean, I've done that market. What I want to do is go after that diminishing market, the private health insurance.
Yeah, you have some percent of your patients are already in that marketplace you want to be in.
Yeah, well, right now it's about 75%, but every year it's going down by 10-15%.
Turn the tape over now for more of the program on Site 2.
But there are a number of patients that you now have that are already the type of patient you're after.
Correct.
Are you going after them for referrals?
Yes.
Okay. Then I would suggest you get a team of employees, some of the 10, and maybe some of those patients, and do some problem solving around them. How can we expand this market? How can we get more of those? Pose the problem to them, leave them alone, and have them come back to you with a solution. I'm sensing you're trying to solve the problem where they're the ones that are close, and ultimately they can solve it better than you can because they're dealing with them every day, as you are probably, but they're dealing with more of them. Give it a shot.
It's the beginning. You got a lot of work to do, but can I make another suggestion?
Sure.
When you listen to these tapes, or if you bought the video, when you watch the video, you're going to see implications that you haven't seen come back to you because your mind was on a different. At each stage, when a different person introduced something else, it changed the whole reference and filtration and receptivity and channeling. And channel tunnels in your mind, I suggest you might get more of the answer you want when you listen the next time. Really, because you'll hear things you didn't hear before. I bet it's there. I really do. And my recommendation to those of you not leaving tomorrow is hang out tonight when we're done, if we're done, if Mike's here, maybe Mike, if he's still here and you're gonna handle this, why don't you basically see if you can get a group to brainstorm for him, okay? Just do an example right here, okay? Do a little project right up here, okay?
Good luck to you.
I just want to add a little thing, Jay,
on
to this question. If you're posing the question mostly in the context of what it is that you're moving away from, that is, if you see your existing market is declining, progressively declining, and because your existing market is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, you got to act before it's too late. That's an away from motivation. You haven't defined what it is truly that you're moving towards.
Good insight.
Excellent insight.
That's a great insight. And that applies to everybody, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So give them a formula. Give everyone a quick
formula.
Give them a formula. And there are more and more problems.
Yes. That's right. You come up with a unique selling proposition that is what you want to be for your patient, for your patients.
Rico, what kind of formula would you give them to find? Give everybody to find that.
Okay. I think firstly we need to recognize there's a hierarchy. We move away from something to get us out of where we're stuck, okay, but we don't continue to move away from something. We're moving progressively towards that which captures more, reflects more and more what our values are. So one thing is that is turning inward, looking a little bit more, reassessing your beliefs, why you're doing what you're doing, what it is that you truly believe about your profession, what it is that you feel you have best to offer, what you feel is within your team, your immediate environment that you're working in. This is what Mike is talking about. You get your team members in your office involved in the process. You come up with that consolidated vision now. That is what you're promoting now in as part of your strategy as you're expanding your markets. See it not as simply a market, as some sort of impersonal thing, but it's really opportunities for new relationships with new clients, new customers, new patients.
Situation, I talked to Mac a little bit about this last night, is We believe in the quality service price pyramid. We're the highest quality and highest service in our industry, but we also end up with the highest price. And I'm sure by most of you that have listened to me, I'm not embarrassed of being the highest price. But I sell to a market that's merchants, and their whole job is one of negotiation. They go and they need T-shirts, and they all, you know, the Hanes T-shirts, the Hanes T-shirts, so they negotiate, whether it be through a job or the vendor, the manufacturer, for the best price and delivery. Then they go out on their floor, and their customers come in, oh, this looks pretty, when's it going on sale? I mean, it's all price, 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 and they're programmed to negotiate. In 11 years, we've never negotiated on price. I mean, we sit down, we decide what's the value, and that's the price. So I would say we probably violate the principle that it's easy to do business with us. We're in a situation now, I will give you a specific that's happened in the last week, where the price of our software system is $50,000, and a lower price competitive product is $40,000. We're selling to a gentleman, we've done all the value add stuff. He'll tell you if both systems are priced at $40,000, he'd pick us. So he's recognized we give him a better value. I guess the question in my mind is, which sort of runs against my nature, should we mark up the goods in order to mark them down and let him negotiate? And then how do I feel for the people who aren't smart enough to negotiate?
I might package in more. I don't think I would ever do that, but I might package in more
front porch
services or benefits.
A front porch?
Pardon?
Something to give away on negotiation.
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be necessary. You may be limiting it. Maybe something else that a retailer could benefit from more. Maybe 2 years worth of something, not just computer related. Maybe 2 years worth of the brightest retail tax accountant in the whole country who's good at finding savings. Or, I mean, that's got to be something. Maybe there's something in a bigger picture that comes when they buy for you, so you're not even competing on the same thing anymore.
Well, he's got a lot of stuff bundled in that he can unbundle if he needs to come in.
Well, that's one of the things.
Right.
Do we, as long as we're within a price zone,
yes.
Do we build it up in order to, you know, have straw men to let them
also,
kick out?
I mean, can you start them on a, can they upgrade? Can you be like the woman whose letter I read that basically took a few of the services away and changed it, but really didn't functionally change her pricing?
Sure.
And you might have, could you try maybe can you retroactively also give them, it's like maybe a certain number of people would start with the stripped down Bel Air model, and with an option, they'd have an option within, maybe you price it so that components were exorbitant in the future, but they had a 90-day window to add them for nothing. I mean, for in other words, if the fully blown unit is $40,000, but the strip down is 20, but the 20 you took off, if they bought it in parts, would be 70.
Right.
But you gave
so
a 90-day retroactive period where they could put it back for the same 20.
Nice.
That makes sense.
That's nice.
Original, that might work.
The original equipment loaded model comes cheaper with the
auctions built in. It's component pricing, it's stereo pricing. It sort of does, but and I've been real careful, Mac, not to say but. I don't know if you've noticed this time. I was a but kind of person. The problem I see, though, is they're buying a suit. It's a holistic unit. So
yeah.
They're not used to taking away. I mean, they want the pack. I mean, you've sold them
but
on that
pack. But
you
might be able to say, maybe this will work enough for you. We think you need all this.
Right.
But we'll start you this way, and it's up to you.
Well, the other thing you can do as a selling tactic is to work up a comparison grid and walk them through the competitive product and see if they have some comparable features.
We do that, and that helps us out. So we might get the 40,000 to 44. Or they're not going to be at our price because they don't offer the quality.
But see, what if you
do? Wait, let me ask you a question. What about meeting the $40,000 price contingent on us meeting financial objectives? In other words, we sort of put ourselves at risk.
That's right. You could say, fine, we'll take the 38 right now, but you put the other two in escrow.
Right.
And you got to sign a performance. Yeah, absolutely. It's brilliant.
So that's,
if it works.
Well, I mean, yeah, we just test. I mean,
no,
in the old days, this is a test.
It's
might
a very good idea. I like it. Thank you, David. You made a great contribution. I'm going to acknowledge as many people as I can at the end, but thank you. Hello.
Lisa Levitt, the Alliance for Fire and Emergency Management, Ashland, Massachusetts. How many months prior to an upcoming seminar should we begin promoting with direct mail?
depends. 6 months.
It depends on the geography, the price. I mean, you can't just say that.
Yeah, I can.
Well,
it does depend on those things, but you need 6 months lead time.
I mean, whenever we promote too late, we mess ourselves up because there's a certain gestation period, and the further from home, the more expensive, the more conceptual, the more unprecedented.
The more it has to get in someone's budget, she's dealing with association.
Yeah, yeah. So the more you got to do that, the longer out. At least would be 3 months. And Mac might be right at 6. It depends on how far the geographic area is, but I hope that helps.
Yeah, I think if the time is getting longer and the number of contacts are getting yet to be more frequent.
And yet you may not get your sign-ups until the week before.
Yeah, right.
We have people here who originally responded 9 or 12 months ago. Isn't that true? Mm-hmm. An inquiry package? Raise your hand if you did. A lot of people here. Well, a few people here.
Make sure you structure your offers so that you there's a significant price kick up a month before.
Yeah. Okay, you're welcome. Is it on? Right here, guys.
Jay, my name is Tom Arkwright from Richmond, Virginia, Instant File Systems. We're a small startup manufacturer, and we've got a short-term capital need between now and, say, January. One of the things that you mentioned on your tapes, your tape set, was going to your vendors and showing them how they have more to gain from our success even than we do. Mm-hmm. And I think that could work real well. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you about was, as far as a startup corporation that may appear to them to be speculative, how do you, bolster the offers?
Find a way to give them the most collateralized certainty you can in the transaction. I have to go through a long interview with you, but we had at one of our programs, Gary whatever, and it was great, his insight. He was a venture capitalist. It doesn't matter whatever his name is. He was a very, very bright guy, and everyone asked him about deals, and he said, what a venture capitalist looks for is not the maximum return on investment, it's the maximum protection of the risk.
If you can show him how he can walk away whole, even if your deal fails, you'll get the money.
That's right.
Because everybody sells blue sky.
Yeah.
But if you can show him that he can walk away whole, that he can walk away with your car
and
at the end of the deal, if everything else fails, and your car's worth what he did, you'll get it.
And also you might say, look, I need 10 or 20 grand from you, but here's what I'll do. First of all, I'll pledge to you 100% of my incremental profit for as long as it takes to get that. Plus, I'll give you a written warrant that as long as you'll price market competitive, we'll deal with you for at least 10 years. All right, I mean, that's give them what they want. Yeah. If we're successful. You. If we're not, I'll give you my firstborn. Of who they won't want. Remember my wife's story?
They want to make sure you're absolutely they want to make sure you're absolutely hooked in, that you can't get out, that you're buried, sunk, drowned.
Next, we've got to move.
Thank you.
Next. I'm gonna burn out, and you gotta get as many again.
Thanks again for the cross section, Jay. Gentlemen, Jerry Rodriguez from Tech Services, Dallas, Texas. I'm the 28 employee DOD emphasized test lab, and Mike convinced me that my gaps show that I need a revolution in the organization. But our esteemed real estate colleague up there, I kind of feel like I'm responsible for helping nurture these people and bring them along and be part of their lives for as long as it's going to roll here.
Right.
And so it's kind of like, Mike, in looking at your progression and going on up through handling those gaps and working these people into the new ideas, I was wondering if you could tell me, or maybe Enrico could tell me, whether I should be looking to expose my personnel to that complete pyramid of the awareness to technique type of discipline themselves. Could you guys discuss that?
Go ahead, you start. Yeah, I like honesty, and I like exposing your employees to everything, including the problems and the down sales or whatever you're into. The more you tell them, in my opinion, the more they get involved and feel like owners in the company. But if you're after a revolution, give them a P&L weekly. All of my clients do that. Tell them exactly how you're doing. Even if you're making loads of money, they need to understand that, and they'll accept that. So the more you tell them, the more honest you are with them, the more you involve them in what's going on, the more they'll take ownership and help you move it forward.
Okay. Well, with that in mind, Mr. Melson, I'd appreciate it if I could get a card from you, and you could give me an idea of where I can get more material on your specific, expertise there, because I would like to see if I can better expose my people to that while I take them through Mike's regimen. Okay?
We're glad to. Just want to add a little bit. I think if we're going to, the real key word that I want to pick up on from Mike is involve. There's a difference between exposing people and involving them. And let's not fool ourselves that we're doing the complete task because we're simply exposing folks to things. So if that's our intention, that'll burn itself out after a while because people will see that we're not really sincere. Management is talking about involvement, but it's not involvement. So I think that's really important. As you begin to look at that, one, again, you have to sort of come back to self. How much can I, as the head of this corporation or this business, or given my constraints in my role, how much can I involve others in this participatory process? Okay, and sometimes what we find is that generally we usually find is that what we thought were our limits, we can exceed those limits in terms of empowering others and involving others. There clearly are operational constraints, there are clearly confidentiality constraints and things like that, and we need to respect that. But recognize that in the involvement process that there is feedback that's coming and you really have a responsibility to make sure then that you're giving feedback to their feedback. If you can't take the feedback and incorporate it directly into new programmatic changes, there still needs to be that reciprocity of information, letting them know that, hey, that's much valued feedback, and perhaps it can't go in right now, but it's part of the process that we're formulating the greater strategic plan or the new marketing for next year or whatever.
Thank you. Sir.
I'm Joseph Wyman with New Discoveries in Learning, Menlo Park, California. And I'm real excited about doing some of the back-end selling, but we need more product. We have a videotape, an audio tape series, a newsletter, and we've got some of the seminars on tape that need to be edited. And we were working out of the house, but Pat and I lost our house to fire last month. So until I get insurance money, we're trying to bootstrap this thing. So I need some help. My question is, where do I find financial partners? What kind of joint venture arrangements? What I look for, how would that be structured?
Well, the progression of seed money in small ventures is first to go to people you're related to.
Mm-hmm.
In all seriousness, to people you're related to people they know, to people you've done business with earlier. Work your personal relations. That doesn't mean you don't make a serious business proposal. You need to make a business plan just as if you were going to the biggest venture capitalist and make sure that everything is regular. But when you're at that stage of development in a business, people will be listening to you on your character. Mm-hmm. There's no assets. There's no cash flow. There's nothing to mortgage. There's nothing that a conventional lender or even an unconventional lender looks at. They'll look at character. Pardon me?
About
small business loans are possible if you have a lot of conditions met. You have to be turned down by conventional lenders to get small business loans. So you have to go through the process anyway. And it might be water torture, but you have to go through all these things, so you might as well do them first.
Okay.
You like to talk to a good tax attorney about what kind of corporate structure you need to raise the money properly, if there's a capitalizable asset, that sort of thing, too.
Hey, Joe, what other products can you sell to those people that someone else has the product? It doesn't have to be your product, so you don't have to wait till you get the money. Maybe you can find somebody else who has a similar product that you could sell to that same client base.
You
can make the money from there.
We have a client base, we have a database.
Well, one of the things you can do, especially since you had, if you've supplied a valuable service to your client base, and you can take advantage of your position by saying, look, I'm in an unusual position. If you would pre-purchase our products, I'll give you advantageous rates till the end of time. If you pre-purchase $1,000 worth of series with me, and put this in our account, you will be a chartered customer, you will always reserve preferential rates, always reserve beta tests on products, and you can raise capital with pre-purchase agreements.
Like a club, start a club right now so they start pre-purchasing right from the beginning and just start to fulfill the
just
service.
Just tell them exactly what your position is and why you're doing it and what your intentions are, and that might be, I don't know how much capital you need, but that might be enough to do it.
Okay.
Sorry, Joe, you made me think of that. That sometimes works.
Jim Grove from the Unique Spectacle. It's a wholesale lab. Mine's really a follow-up question to the last question over here regarding employees. One of my concerns in the whole thing, I've been given a number of tools that I'm optimistic are going to help in the marketing. If that occurs, that's going to require a substantial physical plant expansion, new employees, and there's going to be a lot of dependence on my employees to make that work. There's been a lot of discussion about motivating the employees, leading them to become innovative, empathetic, change in mindset, all of those things. The one thing we haven't talked about, we've talked about financial relationships with getting in new customers and doing different things, but we haven't talked about that in relationship to our employees. Mike made a very quick comment this morning that you didn't like awards for employees that were individually based. I'd like you to elaborate on that just a little bit, if you would.
Yeah, what I like and what we usually implement is team profit sharing. So if you're going back and you've got ideas that produce this much, what I like to do is say, okay, if we did nothing different, we'd achieve this level of profit. However, if we achieve this level, because you all got involved and you all got passionate about serving the customers, then you get a share of that. And then I like to equally divide it where there's lots of formulas. In fact, I'd let them figure out how to divide it because you really don't care. What's the best way of dividing it? So here's a pool of money, and then let's divide it up among the people who produced it. Sam Walton's theory was, you make me rich, I'll make you rich. It's that philosophy that if we all get on the same wavelength and produce more, we're all going to share in the more. The only thing I'm against is when you get into individual, I get this much because I achieved this much, then people begin looking at only themselves and only achieving those numbers rather than achieving the goals of the customer, the employee, and the owner. So that's the concept, and we can spend more time later personally to get into the detail of what you're trying to do. What we set up is profit sharing based on achieving more than the goal, and then they get a percentage of that. And the bigger that number can be, the better, obviously, in terms of motivation. Now, money doesn't motivate attitudes, but it does create focus. And that's what you're trying to do with it, as opposed to motivate. Money just doesn't motivate attitudes. It motivates behaviors, but not attitudes.
I'd add a little bit also. I think that when you're going to introduce profit sharing, that it'd be clear about the sequencing of profit disbursement. I think that if you're looking to get more involvement from your employees and you have this expansion, you're going to be bringing in a lot of new people. These new people are going to have certain impressions. You want to be able to establish a leading impression. And I think that if you're going to have an approach like this, that it's very helpful to be clear as to what they are being rewarded for can be achieved apart from your additional aggrandizement. In other words, we don't want to say we create this kind of additional margin and then you come and take a big chunk out of it and then we can share thereafter. So I think it's very when you can be clear about that, you can impart that message clearly in terms of how you delineate.
So if you structure it to look like table scraps, that's not particularly motivating.
Right, that's not very motivating.
That's okay. Good. Okay, thank you. Which way are you guys going? Max? That way?
Yes, we're going this way, yes.
Hello? I wish you had a few Fuji dollars, don't you, Max?
My name is Lindsay Sheep, Mount Fuji Garden Center. And it was funny because I met this guy that said, oh, you're the guy that does the sod biopsies. I go, yeah. but anyway, I want you to know we've got a lot of ideas. We just have to kind of formulate them now. But anyway, my question is sort of similar to the other gentleman, is that how do we only have 7 full-timers and like 3 part-timers. How do we motivate the employees? This is a retail business, to service the walk-in customers better without making it kind of like a cutthroat sort of situation where they're all trying to, you know, sell the most or sell things that maybe they really don't need or you know, get into someone else's sales. Because our kind of philosophy is that we want to do and sell things to our customers that they need, not what we want to sell them. You know, it's kind of
like
so what's that? Are your people commissioned?
No, they're not right now.
So
they're kind of floating around and they don't kind of actively approach the customers as quickly.
I'd give that problem to them as a task. I'd say, how do we blow away the, you know, in a positive way, the walk-in customer? How can we do that?
and have them get together, problem solve around that, and come back to you with how they're going to do it, and then let them do it. Set up the goals, the measurements. Be clear about what you want. We don't want to oversell them. We want to build trust in the transaction, and then let them come back to you with the solutions. And when they do come back, tell them what you like about them, tell them your concerns, and then work with them to overcome any concerns. And then once you've got it, then go wholeheartedly to implementing what they came up with.
Because we started them some kind of a program like that. We took them to dinner and we talked about it, you know, and I don't know if we really got
it. Here's the difference.
You know what? Why don't you just show them tonight? Why don't you do a model tonight?
Well, we could do a model, yeah. If one of you wants to come in with a problem, I'll use the process.
Why don't you have the model? Whatever gentleman
the difference is this. Normally what most companies do is they'll talk about it, they'll discuss it, or they'll get ideas from people. And what you got to make clear is we don't want ideas. We want a recommended solution and plan. So that when you come back to us, what I expect back from you is a solution to the problem, not ideas that we have to act on, but ideas that you're going to act on to make this happen. So you begin to move that responsibility from you, the manager or the store owner or whatever, down to them, who are the ones that really have to carry it out. I mean, we entitle people in this country all, you know, first they were entitled to a paycheck and then health care benefits. Now a lot of people have the feeling they're entitled to be motivated, and they're not. Your job is to give them the problem, let them solve it, and in that process, they'll motivate themselves, and that's what you're after.
Recognize you're not dumping on them in the process,
yeah, exactly.
But you're actually incorporating them, you're empowering them to come up with a creative solution to the problem that everyone benefits from.
It's amazing, once they get in that creative cycle, how excited they get. Jay talked to the client that I was dealing with in Rochester, and he pretty excited about the people.
He was extraordinarily excited.
Once the people got in, this is the owner of the Mercedes franchise, but he's excited because his people, I mean, he said when they came out of that meeting, it was a 2 6-hour meeting, 2 days, 6 hours each day. He said, when they came out of the meeting, they were knocking on my door, interrupting my meeting to tell me what I needed to do next to support them in making this happen for them. And then that's the kind of excitement you want to generate.
One structure you might put on the table to start the discussion is a shared commission or shared bonus structure and see if they like that or any permutation of that.
We're going to go for hours. And start at that point because Mike will be here tonight. And maybe Rico will hang out. Rico, you hang out?
I'll be here.
Hey, Rico will hang out too. And Joe, you can hang out too if you like. But you don't have to. But we could. You can even put a tent up here. We got to move. Thank you very much. Mike, on over here, please.
Hello.
Good.
Dennis Nagel, Grand Rapids, Michigan, General Dennis. I'd like to thank you, Jay, for bringing us all together. All of you, too. I'm very grateful.
Thank you.
I, as a general dentist, have to work in my business at the same time that I work on it, because I'm part of the production line. Michael, you mentioned working 22-hour days. What advice do you have to give us to keep our lives in balance while we commit a revolution?
In other words, you're working long hours, and you want to do the revolution, and how can you keep your life in balance while you're going through this?
It sounds like maybe you paid a price. I'm not sure. Maybe you could describe it to us a little bit. We all have personal lives, too.
You want to know how not to pay that price.
How do you have a personal life?
What's balance? You know, how do you find balance?
How many people in your practice? One dentist? How many dentists?
Just myself.
And then how many staff?
Four.
Four staff? I guess, and this might be more appropriate after dinner, I could give you the step-by-step process that Patty Lund, the dentist, went through in terms of achieving what he did. The key to it is that those four men, I'm working with my dentist, by the way, back in Colorado Springs. There are two dentists and four staff. And basically what we're doing is working with the staff and the dentist to come up with how they're going to do it. We have them list the hierarchy of horrors. And frankly, the staff started out with their horrors. They were too far behind in their work until they could get caught up. So then they met to figure out how they could get caught up. And then they got caught up. Once they got caught up, then they could begin focusing on the customer problem.
Good.
And now it's a smooth-running machine. But it started out with them getting involved.
A few little things that I recommend from time to time for people who have more hours to work than there are hours in the day, or close to it, are to not simply look at everything in large chunks of time. You know, for example, if you've got patients scheduled from 7 in the morning until 5 in the evening, then you may have a little slot in between where you can get something to eat. There really are multiple slots. Those slots may be 1 minute, maybe 5 minutes. So part of that capturing or recapturing of your personal life and then balancing your personal life is recognizing that there are many, many more opportunities for you to experience your own humanity during the course of this very long and very busy day. You can make connections to your family by fax machine. You can invite that with your own, with your staff. For example, you may just say, I'm working late tonight. My employees are allowed to make a home call. Or they can use the fax machine and write a little message and send it for people who have home faxes. We take a few minutes of a break and we do something creative and we send out a card to various people. So little things like that. And of course, the same thing applies to being able to take a few minutes and just go into silence. And if that means you have to disconnect the phones or whatever it is, do so. But the value is much greater than what appears to be the expenditure of energy and time at that moment.
One thing my dentist did that I think is very worthwhile to look at, he went to 4 10-hour days a week as opposed to 5 days, and they worked now only 180 days a year by plan. They schedule around that, they run their practice around that. It's been quite successful for them.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
My name is John Phillip with Hurricane Systems, and I want to say thank you. We've had a great experience. And we sell capital equipment, and we've got some great things to do in the area of direct mail, telemarketing, and then also back-end selling. Our average sale is about $75,000 to $85,000, and we want to explore some things in the area of risk reversal. And we've been kind of wrestling with that, and we haven't really been able to come up with
what is it? What is the actual piece of equipment? What is it?
Industrial part washing equipment.
Okay, and it's $85,000?
Well, it could be that. That's about our average.
Now, let me ask you this question real quickly. What is the biggest tangible result that someone will receive if they install your equipment to replace the other?
A clean part once it comes off the line.
Okay, but that's not the result. What's the what's the implication of that result? What will a cleaner part mean to them in terms of either warranty claims, dependability, quality of performance, downtime? What are the implications? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Well, the implications of a cleaner part means that they'll have happier customers.
But if you can drive it further, that's what Jay's trying to
say. What I'm saying is, maybe you didn't get what I was saying, but let me tell you even in more clarified manner. What I'm saying is this. You help them realize what their picture will look like on a result basis. If you say, right now, the system you've got is producing a breakdown or a faulty product incidence of 1 in 100, and you figure what you're doing is the true to the bad parts. And they have to help you. They got to give you the data. You're not going to walk into it. You do an assessment. We've done this for a lot of people. The way to do it in risk guarantee is you do an assessment where you correlate, and you analyze, and you evaluate, and you examine, and you uncover what the real implications financially or productivity-wise or claim-wise are. Then you do an extrapolation based on using yours, and you can guarantee that result. In other words, if right now their claims are 10% of sales, and it can be determined clearly that those are attributed to bad parts that are going through the wash system, and you know that yours are going to come out 10 times better, and it's reasonable to say that that will be reduced by 40%, and a reduction of 40% saves them not only the downtime, not only the replacement labor, not only the replacement part, but you calculate out what that all means, and you show them this will save you $1 million in 3 years based on these assumptions, as long as you perform such and such. And if you do that, if we don't save you that, as long as you give us reports every week and everything else, which can make it a stipulation, and we have a chance to go in and readjust if there's a problem, or you're not doing something right, or you're having a higher incidence of bad parts or something, then we'll guarantee that if it doesn't hit $1 million, we'll give you the prorated down to, back down to whatever. That's a pretty good way, isn't it? It worked for a lot of people. We got a very expensive part company that deals with General Motors to do it, and it worked for them. Anyhow, thanks. Which way are we going? That way? Hi. Are these all people up?
It's been a great 3-day, better than MBA. I think it's maybe under-promise in your literature a little bit. Our issue is kind of an interesting one. We deal when our success is dependent on retailers, since we sell to them and they sell to the consumer. And we didn't talk a lot about that kind of distributor-type relationship in the meeting. We know that over the last decade, their sales are basically flat and their profits half of what it used to be. Yet when we ask them what their biggest issues are, it's price and a bunch of other things, and marketing comes way down the list. We believe, and certainly I do after the last 3 days, that marketing is number one. How do we put that there? What's the best way to put the channel in alignment so that everybody...
So
our customers, the retail florists...
I think the same way we did it for you. You can't shove it down their face. You got to progressively do it in little spoon-fed... I mean, I did it to you in a series of successions. You might not want to read to them like I read to you on the first day, but you might want to find a succession of logical... first thing, show them, like I tried to show you, that it has nothing to do with the market. It has nothing to do with the economy. It has nothing to do with competition. It has everything to do with them, and that's wonderful because it means they have control to immediately change all that. And I think you have to get them to realize they have always had that control, and then explain to them where it lies, and then help them. And maybe sometimes we can work together. You'd be fun to work with, frankly.
Okay, great.
Thanks for coming.
My name is Don Hunt with America's Marketing Innovators. And, Jay, first of all, the Hunt brothers really appreciate your marketing wisdom that you shared with
us. Thank you.
We have two concepts. One of them allows us to set up a complete pizza shop in any food business for an investment of $400 to $700, and this can produce an extra income for the operator of about $50,000 a year. Plus, we have a distributor concept that services these accounts weekly in an exclusive territory out of route sales, and the income from this will run anywhere from $50,000 to $150,000 a year.
Okay.
Now, my question is, what is the fastest and easiest way to find or sell individual distributorships across this country?
Go to biz op shows.
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't do that.
Oh.
I wouldn't. I'd go to somebody who's already sold their products and not competitive biz ops to somebody else and do a joint venture with them. It's a lot faster and probably more probable if they got a good look.
As a host parasite?
Yeah. I sold $250,000 worth of attendances to the protege training through Rick Niswanger's just inquiries. He wouldn't let me have his clients, but in spite of that, we got a bunch of his clients. They just saw the ad, they saw the promotion in Entrepreneur Magazine, but I think you're making a mistake. I mean, I think there's an easier way to do it.
Well,
I mean, you got to go to biz op shows, you got to go all over the country, and you got, there's no leverage in it. Find somebody who's already gone to biz op shows and done everything possible, run $2 million worth of ads in Entrepreneur Magazine, who's already got
some of the biz op shows these days are actually mailing tickets to people who are already on their list, so you get some free
profit. Okay, well, that's good too, but he said he asked what the fastest is.
Yours would certainly be the fastest.
Mine's fastest and mine's got more. I'm not trying to disregard, I don't want to argue.
I agree with you, it would be.
But it's much more, mine's more leverage.
Okay, would you say...
Really?
Yeah, you're right.
My base is find somebody who's already got your customer. There's a lot of people who sold business opportunities. Who's the woman here who owns five that she's not operating? She's still here? The woman who stood up and said she had five businesses she owns, and she wasn't doing anything with any of them? Well, there are people, if you've got... And what you want to do is within the realm of the Stamp Act and the securities law and the Franchise Act and everything else that governs you federally and statewide, make sure you can say this. But if you can say, look, we know if you set this up, it'll cost you $700. If you perform on these seven things and fail to make your $700 back within 6 months, we'll give you a pro rata of everything up to 100% as long as the equipment hasn't been abused. I mean, that's pretty powerful, isn't it?
We have no problem. They make it back in a month.
As you said, that's what you do. But find somebody else to endorse it. And if your big deal is you don't even care about the equipment, you care about distributing the pizzas,
right. Then
go to somebody who's already got a bunch of biz ops installed, but they're not competitive, and say, you know, give them 90% of the profit or 120% of the profit. Say, I'd like to make $700 for selling a $700 product, and we'll do all the work, and we'll even fund the mailing and take the cost off of your money if it works, and if it doesn't, we'll take the loss.
You're the best marketer I know. I'm going to come to you. Thank you, sir.
Bye. I'm sorry, Mac. I just think that was a faster way.
Rhonda Applegard from the Hudson Center, Omaha, Nebraska, Psychotherapy and Counseling.
You said you'd tell me the story about the psychiatrist and his five associates.
Is that your question?
Pardon?
Is that your question? Yes, my question. We also, I'd like to see the rest of your books. I'd like you to send it.
Okay, good. Yeah, I'll send you the package. Okay. I have a few with me, but not all of them.
All right. Okay, very simple. I had a psychiatrist. He was a very good person. He specialized in depression, despondency, suicide. He was great, but he was not inexpensive. He was looking for an approach. I asked him to tell me where most of his business came from. Referrals from other physicians, referrals from institutions, from organizations, from public community-type programs. I said, well, I'll give you what I learned in $250,000 worth of therapy. Would you like that?
We could have told you in two sessions, probably.
Well, I wish I would have known you. Yeah. But I'll do it quick. First of all, what I said was, well, okay, so where does your business come from? And I said, well, I'll tell you my experience, and I wanted to just confirm. I said, I always found it was really annoying the first time you ever met with a therapist, because you spend 45 or 55 of the first 60 minutes, if it's a 60-minute session, or 45 of the first 50 if it's a 50-minute session, trying to get comfortable, trying to open up, trying to really get, you know, like a feel for each other. And insult to injury, about the time you're really ready to start talking, your time's up and you got to write a check for 75 or 100 or 100.
You haven't got anything.
And I said, if I were doing it, I would go to all the endorsing referring agencies and say, I thought about this and it's not right. It's not right that somebody who's already depressed should come to me, feel terribly intimidated about trying to open up, sit for 45 minutes in greater intimidation, just start to talk, not feel comfortable, and then have to pay me $150. I decided if there's going to be a risk, I'd rather take the risk on them. So I decided if you have students, patients, whatever, who you think could really benefit, and they're depressed or despondent or suicidal, refer them to me, and I'll be happy to buy them the first session, during which time it'll be less constrictive, less intimidating. They'll be able more comfortably to open up to me, and we can easily and more effectively determine whether I can be helpful to them and whether they would feel comfortable with me. If they do, then they'll feel comfortable going forward, and that'll be great. If they don't, they won't at least feel worse and more depressed. And when he did that, him and the brother started referring. And I said to him, this is not meant to sound funny, I said, if I get you 10 depressed people on that basis, how many will stay? The guy's brilliant. He's brilliant. He's very nice. He's very much like Deepak. He's an Indian-based, very, very, very Eastern philosophy type of a psychiatrist. He's very comforting, very reassuring. He said, well, you know, if we're compatible, 7. I said, well, how long would they stay with you? And he said, well, it depends. But probably a year and a half. I said, well, so does that help?
It helps, but part of our problem is we're brief solution-oriented therapists, and so we don't spend, you know, the first year getting comfortable with you and all that.
We have great results.
We have great results.
So basically tell them that they've got to come for 3 sessions. If they haven't had results in 3 sessions, you write them a check right back for all the money. I'll resolve your whatever the malady or the phobia for $79, and it doesn't matter to us whether you pay it up front, whether you pay it over 3 months, whether you pay it starting the third month. It doesn't matter. Being flexible and one shot, that might be fun. What do you think, man? Yeah. Okay.
I think you're right, though. No, it isn't a package. It's
not a package. A package is the wrong way. It's a solution.
Right.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Okay. By the way, the answer, I don't have time to tell you all about it. I used to go crazy almost about every 3 years, and it got very frustrating to me to pay $150 and just start talking. I can talk your head off. And by the time I start talking, the bell would go off. And I got tired of that, so I thought, all I want to do is talk it through. So I basically would buy somebody for a whole week. I could afford it, you know, $5,000, $7,000. And I'd say, I may take it for a day, may take it for the whole week until I get myself talked through. I've been doing all this for so long, I realized one important thing. This is what I got for $250,000. I'm going to tell you. It's true. Most people are obsessed in life with achieving an end product. You want to be the dominant force in your market. You want to make $1 million. You want to make Jim Schaefer, in a minute I'll tell you what I wanted. You want to make 25% increases a year. You want to have a perfect body. You want to have the most beautiful wife. You want to have whatever you want to have. A house on the hill, whatever. Mercedes automobile, Rolls Royce. When you get it, you realize that is anticlimactic. That doesn't give you any joy. What life is all about is the process. This is as good as it gets, and I mean that with great reverence. And when you realize that everybody, everything, every day, every interaction is a joyous, glorious experience, it changes the context of how you look at life. It's no longer drudgerous, it's exhilarating. That's my little lesson. I just saved you $250,000. Thanks a lot.
Jay, those problems that you addressed were in many ways totally unique. Fascinating to hear your response. It seems like both you and the people involved were at the very best of thinking. Is that your experience?
Well, I mean, you got to realize the question and answer session is normally the last part of the last day of an extraordinary three-day process I put people through, which is quite paradigm shifting and quite mindset expanding and quite exhilarating. Their clarity and their focus and their understanding of the critical areas of opportunity and possibility in their business has been increased manyfold.
Jay, thanks for your insights today. We'll be thinking about these in the month to come. You've been listening to Jay Abraham, marketing genius, on The Wizard's Edge. This is Marty Stacey. Talk to you next time. Bye-bye. Welcome to another edition of The Wizard's Edge with marketing genius Jay Abraham. On this edition of The Wizard's Edge, we'll hear from Jay and some of his associates talking about business problems and business solutions. You'll hear marketing insights you'll hear nowhere else. To start out today's edition of The Wizard's Edge, here's the wizard himself, Jay Abraham, talking about the 10 major marketing mistakes. Listen and learn with the wizard.
10 marketing mistakes everybody's making and how to avoid them. Boom. Not testing. You realize you can test and you must test all kinds of things. You must test, first of all, ads. Headlines first in the ad. The headline's the ad for the ad. The headline is 80 to 90% of the effect. The headline is not just a headline in an ad. It's the opening sentence that your salespeople utter when they say something, when they meet somebody, when they talk to somebody on the phone. It is the opening paragraph or sentence in the letters you send out. It is the phrase that you use in point of purchase. It is so powerful it can make such a difference. You test propositions, meaning the very offer you make. You test rationale or reasons why. You test compositions like the package or the combination. You test guarantees in the way they are stated. You test calls to action. And you test everything. And when you get a definitive answer, that's only the beginning. You constantly retest against that because whatever works becomes your control, and your job as an optimal marketer is to see how many ways, how often, how many better improvements you can make to increase and surpass what your control does. You test so many different things. Is there a question? Nope? Okay. Running institutional advertising instead of direct response advertising. We explained to you earlier, everything you do should be intent to evoke a direct response. Every ad you run, every letter you send out, every communication, every time a salesperson has a contact, you should try to engage somebody and not just have a buy or a no buy or an agreement to talk or not. They should always be evoking some respondable action from you. A report you send them, they come in to get an analysis, a review, a free consultation, a sample, a trial that you can put on that you can send out. I don't like multi-level. Everyone knows that. I don't like network marketing very well because I don't think they teach you how to sell through. They just try to get people to buy in. However, what I think is very interesting is one of them called NSA, if it's still in business, it's a water conditioner one. And they got such a simple, simple process. You get a water conditioner. You lend it to somebody for 30 days. You install it portably on their kitchen. You say you'll come back in 30 days and either take it away or let them keep it and buy it. And they have a third of the people, I think, that buy it. Previewing and sampling is a very powerful technique. You should try that, if nothing else, as the response device in you use. It's a very powerful technique, isn't it, Vic? Previewing, sampling, trying something on a free trial? Yeah, it's worked for him. We're going to have him in a picture in our next. It worked for me. V. Conant, personal development publisher. Marketing mistake 3, not ascertaining and developing a unique selling proposition, articulating it clearly as an integral part of all of your marketing. So powerful, so powerful. You need to distinguish yourself. You can't do a USP until you first understand the most powerful results or various results your product produces as clearly and dimensionally denominated as possible in the eyes of the end user. And then you find the hierarchy. And you might have multiple USPs, but there's one big one you telegraph to different segments of your prospect list. Without a USP, you are a commodity. That almost rhymes, doesn't it, man? We should do a rhyme about it. You know? I really wish I had my theme song. That was neat. That was sort of cute. You guys don't have my theme song, do you? Do you? You have it here? The one that they wrote in Australia? You have Ghostbusters. I got this great theme song somebody wrote for me in Australia. It's really cute. We played it a couple times. It's very cute, but I don't have it here, unfortunately. If you don't have a USP, your success is accidental. That's all I can say. What do you think, Matt? I mean, that's it. I mean, it's that powerful. It's that significant. And if you have one... Yeah, if you can't sit... If you guys, I'll tell you what I'd do tonight if I were you. Because most people don't have a good one. I'd spend a lot of the evening, because I'm hoping I've stimulated your mind, you won't sleep. And why waste the time going to bed when you got this wonderful opportunity to interact with still probably 80 or 100 very profound thinkers and like-minded, bright, articulate, resourceful, enterprising, agile-minded people whose minds are abuzz on similar issues. I'd sit across each of you and rotate around and just use this room because we paid for it for the night. They won't like it if we stay around, but who cares? And I'd keep going from partner to partner and seeing if you can explain in 60 or 120 minutes so powerfully and clearly what advantage distinguishes you from your competitors. Because this person, if you can't tell it to somebody, you can't sell it to somebody. Boy, I'm coming up with good news. Wow. Write that down.
I will.
That's good. I'm going to forget that, but that's good.
That's good, yeah.
That is good. I'm going to write that one down. I can't remember it.
If you can't tell it to somebody, you can't sell it to somebody.
So I would do a little exercise and find your best USP. And then there could be multiple ones. When you get one, your goal in life. Remember I talked to you about Deming and this concept of optimization? You got a baseline. Whatever you are, whatever you're at now is your base or your standard. You got two factors. You got baseline measured. You got process, baseline within process, variance. Your goal in life. Raise the baseline, lower the variance. Raise the baseline, lower the variance. Very simple. At the same time, you got to analyze and you got to know where your business is coming from. Because most of you don't. You do lots of things and you don't quantify, you don't measure, you don't analyze, you don't compare, you don't project out. Until you know where it's coming from, you can't possibly optimize because you're not putting the maximum effort in the maximum area. You're not getting the absolute return. You don't know how much you can allocate to anything. You just can't do anything until you measure. Not having a back end. Anybody who only has a front end is, I'll put it very politely, stupid, dumb, ignoramus, like, and absolutely has a very low aspiration level for their wealth, their family, and the fate of their business. That was tactful, wasn't it? Once they know they should have it, yeah. And if you say, well, I don't have a back end, the back end can be the fact that you're a front end for somebody else. So ask yourself this question. What else and who else would benefit the most by having access to my customers?
Or you can be a back end for someone else.
Oh, yeah, or that's right. Or am I a back end for somebody else? Who else would be benefit me or whose customers would be benefited by my product most? Where are they? How can I access them? What kind of deal can I make with them? Make a list. Find out within that list who the people are. Get a list within that list categorically. If you make a list of generic kinds of companies, local, national, regional, direct mail, mail order, direct selling, find out who they are. Start a progressive process of approaching them. You will probably get turned down on the first call. That's okay. Go to ones that are not terribly, terribly important in the beginning. Statistics have proven that today people need to be approached 5, 6, 7 different successive times before they can close a highly conceptual, high potential sale. Don't give up the first time. How many of you got my information at first and it was so foreign that you couldn't embrace it? Raise your hand. How many of you still didn't understand, even though you read it and listened to it when you came here on Friday? Raise your hand. How many does it make more sense now that you've seen it and it's had time to gestate? Makes a lot more sense. Remember whoever talked about the record? Who was talking about the record? You hear it so often. Who here was
the record?
All right, that was a great point, I thought, didn't you think? He was talking about for radio, but I think it has immense...
Oh, the commercials. He's talking about commercials.
I think it's got even more applicability to concepts.
Oh, yes.
Concepts that seem repugnant or foreign or incongruous are... That won't work. You got to change your language. You never again say, that won't work. Say, what about that might work? Or how could I make that work?
If it did work,
what would I need to do? How can I apply what that person is doing to my business?